Welcome to our Wednesday Business Talks podcast. I am Dr. Shai Vivekanam, Director of the Bettany Center for Entrepreneurship here at Cranfield School of Management. We're live today from the School of Management on our Cranfield University campus in Bedfordshire. Joining us today is Jerome Mayhew, Managing Director of Go Ape, the outdoor adventure company. Jerome's talk is based on the innovation journey of the company and especially the three phases of growth, from early concept to building a business, and finally scaling up.
Hi everyone. First thing is, brilliantly, tech does work. Okay, so my name's Jerome. I work at Go Ape. Hands up who knows what Go Ape is. So two-thirds of you do. Heard of Go Ape or haven't been on Go Ape. What we do, our primary product is high ropes adventure courses. So you come to one of our forests, we fit you in a harness, we teach you what you should do for 30 minutes, 40 minutes, and then you climb up into the sub-canopy of the trees, and you make your way from tree to tree via a series of obstacles, Tarzan swings, wobbly planks, rope bridges, and zip wires. And it takes 2 to 3 hours for our main adult course, and then we have other products as well, which we'll come on to briefly during the course of this evening. Okay, so I've been asked by Shai to, first of all, describe ourselves as a super growth company, which feels very uncomfortable, because it's setting yourself up for a fall, isn't it? But anyway, move on from that. And he's asked me to talk about a few things. So a blast through our past, the story of Go Ape, the story so far, how did we go from startup through the ups and downs of a startup and then getting into a little bit bigger, and building a brand, which perhaps is very precious to my heart and the heart of all of the founders of Go Ape, which is a very, very intense expression of the business. Some of the highs and lows, and he's very keen that we talk about the chasms, the inflection points. So I'm going to do my best, Shai. Right, the story. So the real entrepreneurs, I'm sorry to disappoint you, are my brother Tristram and his wife Rebecca. Triss and Bex were living in London in about 2001, 2002. Triss had been in the army for 7 or 8 years, and then when he got married, he felt that it was incompatible with family life. He had to come out and thought, I'd better learn about business. So he joined one of the biggest companies in the world, you've all heard of it, Coca-Cola, and got some marketing experience at Coke, and then moved to an even bigger American business, General Electric, and was based in a really nasty part of the suburbs of London, part of Croydon. And he was the European Rail Freight, he was the marketing manager for their European Rail Freight division. So glamorous it wasn't, and it was, just knowing Triss as I would do, so not him, because he's full of ideas, he's full of fears, he wants to get going, he thinks he's always right. And he joined a multinational organization where he said that you could tell how senior someone was by counting the roof tiles, the ceiling tiles in their office, because it was that stratified that whatever level of seniority was meant you had an exactly similar or slightly bigger sized office. And so you could go in, you glanced at the roof just to see how senior the person was that you were talking to. And he found that incredibly frustrating because he had all these ideas which he thought were right, and they knew they weren't right and told them so fairly frequently, I think. So it was a frustrating square peg in a round hole. And he and I used to talk quite a lot because we're quite close as brothers. At that stage, I was a barrister in London, minding my own business doing that. But he'd ring up and say, oh my life's shit, and I'm having this really, really difficult time at work. Is this what life is meant to be? Having had good fun in the army for his 20s, and then coming in, married life, responsibilities, the dead-end job in an office somewhere in Croydon. It wasn't looking rosy. And he said, but what I really love, I love trees, and I really love teepees as well. And there I was in my three-piece suit in the Inns of Court in London. I had this vision of my hippie brother going off down to Cornwall and living in a teepee and hugging trees and generally going off the rails. But what they did instead was they went to France on holiday. And they were down somewhere in the middle of France, and they picked up a flyer for a Forêt de l'Aventure by chance. They thought, let's go and have a look at this. and they're walking through the forest, couldn't see anything, it was a sunny day, but what they could hear was the laughter of people in the treetops. And they just thought, how fantastic. Yeah, in a sunny forest, beautiful environment, you can hear people laughing in the treetops. They thought, whatever this feels great. And it was the eureka moment. That is the idea. So, like all ideas, it was someone else's, all the good ones anyway. And they thought, here it is in France. Why isn't this in England? Why can't we do this in the UK? And so that was the big question mark. They took a home video of somebody else's business, and they took it back to the UK and thinking, right, what can we do? So this is where some of you might be, which is at the planning stage. Do I start? Do I take the leap? Do I go for an entrepreneurial idea? So Tristram, his real background was in the army, so he applied military thinking to the problem. Because it's a great idea, but it doesn't need a huge amount of capital investment to build ropes courses in the forestry. So his big fear was that if it worked, then the big boys would see it and they'd copy it. And they'd be able to go further, faster. And Tris would be some bloke in Norfolk who had a ropes course. And Merlin or somebody else like that, or Disney, would have 300 Go 8 courses. And you know, what a good idea they had. So he said, right, we're going to dominate the key ground, deny it to the enemy, all very military. And then the other thing he brought from the army days was to protect your supply chain and disrupt the enemies, which all sounds very militaristic. What that actually meant was that he thought, well, the key thing here is location. It's not just having any old tree. You want to have it in honeypot locations where you've got lots of people coming by. The infrastructure's already there. So you've got the car park, you've got the loos, which are really expensive if you're a startup. You don't want to be building loos, very expensive. You've got the cafe, restaurant, you've got the throughput of people going there with the intention to awful word, recreate. So he thought, who has trees in England? And the answer was the Forestry Commission. They own 20% of the nation's forestry. They had a nationwide network of these visitor centres, 17 around the country. And so he thought, right, if I can sew up the Forestry Commission, then I can dominate the key ground. And then if I can find out who the best builder is and say, have an agreement where they only work for me, then he's not actually denying the supply chain to other people, but he is staking out his pitch as being in the preferred bidder. So he went to the Forestry Commission in Norfolk, and he showed the regional manager there a home video of somebody else's business in France and said, can I do this, please? And to their enormous credit, because this is a governmental organization, but it's much easier to say no, this chap said, actually, this is the great idea that we didn't know we were missing. Yeah, this would be fantastic. Why not? I'm going to help you to get this going. And the Forestry Commission, I'm going to give you a 3-year deal for one site here. Once you've been up and running for 3 years, we'll have a look and see how you're doing, and we'll take it from there. And if Tristram did one clever thing, it was to say no to that offer, because the cat's out of the bag then, and he doesn't have the security. If it's successful, then the Forestry Commission will want their pound of flesh at that stage. You're taking all the risk, and you're setting up the business for them. So he said, no, I want a national agreement. They said, oh, well, we can't do that in Norfolk. You'll have to go down to Bristol. So off he went to Bristol, and he took me along, actually, on this occasion, as I was minding my business as a barrister, thinking this all looks very risky. But I knew a little bit about commercial negotiation. And so the two of us went down to Bristol to Mr. Big. And we went in thinking, right, we want to have a four or five site deal, and we're going to go for 20 years. And not quite sure how, but we walked out that day with a multi-site, nationwide, exclusive agreement for 26 years. And anyway, amazing, but we did. And I'm enormously grateful to the Forestry Commission for putting faith in us at a very early stage and backing us. And they benefited enormously from that. We're their biggest supplier of income after cutting down trees and car parks. And it's helped us enormously. It's allowed us to create a business. So well done, then. And I've also mentioned that we tied up the, or Tristan rather, tied up the supply as much as we could. So you've done a certain amount of planning, but you don't actually know whether it's going to work. Now, bigger businesses, and if I was doing it now, I probably would do some market research and some testing. You spend £30,000-£40,000. Most of it's a total waste of money, because the real test is to build it and see if it works. Because you can do, it's probably going against all what you're told in places like this, but you actually do have to put your money where your mouth is and do it. And if you can do that without betting the farm, great. If you have to bet the farm, maybe you should. And you've just got to go for it. So you can see here, I've got a couple of photographs from the very early days. There was the teepee, it made it. That was our international headquarters in a garden of a rented farmhouse in Suffolk. And the booking system was a mobile phone and a desk diary, which was out in the forest. And they just built it. They got the French over, they built it. They recruited some pretty odd-looking people to work for you, because that's the other thing, is when you're a startup, you do not tend to attract MBA graduates. You tend to attract screwballs and misfits who think they're going to have a different life in the forest. And yeah, you have to go through that. That's necessary if you're in the outdoor adventure business like us. And we'll come on to how you move up the feeding scale or whatever it's called. But you've just got to go for it. So they did, and they built the first course, and in 2002, I think March 2002, opened the first one at Thetford Forest on the Norfolk-Suffolk border. And it was an immediate, huge success. It was a huge success. People loved it. The pricing point was totally wrong. They were at £11 per head, and we're now at between £33 and £35 a head. So that encouraged a certain degree of enthusiasm amongst our customers. People just loved it. And it's one of those euphoric, brilliant moments when you've got something which works. And it's really popular with your customers. So Tristram thought, this is totally brilliant. They had a bookkeeper and said, look, we're doing really well. I want to build three new courses for 2003. Will we be able to do it? The bookkeeper looked at the projection and said, yeah, we're going to be able to do that. So that's what they did. They got planning permission for Moors Valley down near Bournemouth, Grisdale up in the Lake District, and Sherwood in Nottinghamshire. And it nearly killed the business because, if we go on to the next slide, this was all part of the land grab to prevent other people jumping in there. But the first one, Moors Valley, was delayed in the planning process by 6 or 7 weeks. And Grisdale was fine, that worked according to plan. But Sherwood was a bit underwhelming. It didn't take off in the same way in the first 2 or 3 years there. And so the money didn't come in as they're expecting. And we employed all this team. And the bookkeeper said, we cannot pay the wages at the end of the month. And so Tris said, well, okay, I've got a swanky bank I've banked at all my life. He went along to them and said, I need to get over this funding hump, this cash flow, classic cash flow crisis. And he said, I'll go to my bank and they'll give me an overdraft for some tens of thousands of pounds, but not masses of money. And they said, we'd be delighted to help you, but it will take us 12 weeks to go through the credit funding cycle. And he had 3 weeks. So what is a great business very nearly died because of cash flow, not understanding cash flow. In fact, barely being able to count, I now realize, my brother, because he, when they were first doing the planning of this, he didn't account for VAT, so he mixed up gross and net revenue. Anyway, who knew? But, the reason why I tell you that isn't to make me feel bigger than my brother, although that is quite good. It's actually to say, you don't have to be a brilliant businessman to start a successful business. You can learn a hell of a lot on the way. But what you'll never be a brilliant businessman unless you start your business. So, you can think about that a little bit. The way we survived was the time-honored fashion of the bank of mum and dad, or in this case, the bank of mum. Our grandfather had, you know, very sad, but he'd helpfully died 18 months earlier. And so my mother had some cash in a bank account, and she lent £60,000 to my brother for 6 weeks. And that got him over the hump, and taught him a lesson that he will never forget, which is, if at all possible, get a finance director. Numbers really do matter. If you can't afford a finance director, which we couldn't, get one for one day a month. And there's loads of organisations now where you can get really quite qualified and experienced FDs. You get them for one day a month, and then as you grow, that becomes 2 days a month, and then one day a week, and you go up. And that's what we did. And then that FD eventually became our full-time finance director. It's really, really important startup advice. Okay, so that's the first chasm, which is, you know, having the idea, proving the concept. So we got over that, and then between 2000 and whenever that was, 2003 up to 2005-06, we bumped along. We got over that hump. Those sites started becoming more successful, but it was all down to Tris and Bex working very, very hard, scurrying around the country, doing everything themselves. And they recruited very early doors, after about 6 months, an old friend from the army to come in and help with the operations. He ran a site, and then he took over oversight of some of the operational things around the country. But then he was doing it all himself as well. And it was okay, because the business wasn't that big. We employed, I don't know, 85, 90 people at that stage. You knew everyone, you could get together, you could transmit your values and what you're trying to do, you're all part of the conversation. And it got to 2006 with some pretty serious bumps in the road, lack of systems on health and safety. Very lucky, you know, in the first couple of years, would have killed, you know, not only killed a customer, but it would have killed the business as well. Because they didn't have the defensibility in place, they didn't have the paperwork that should be all there. But they got through it. And they got to 2006, and pause for breath, and you think, well, what do we do? We've got a business which has a turnover at that stage with six or seven sites. It had a turnover of 4 million, and it had an EBIT of £410,000. So that is a successful business. And they paid themselves a little bit, but you know, they had salaries. And you think, that's great. We're a happy family. We're successful. Everyone loves us. And we're making money. And we're living out in Suffolk. We're not living in East Croydon. So is this the answer? Is this success? And to answer that question, they went to school. They came to this school. So Will and Tris, so ops director and Tris, came to the BGP in 2006 with the, you know, we've got to write a business plan. And you won't be totally surprised to learn that the BGP process said, no, this isn't the answer, this is the beginning, and you need to go for growth. Because if you don't grow, first of all, your competitors will grow, and they will take your space. But also, you're not going to be creating worthwhile careers for all the good people in your team. And the good ones will develop their careers, but they'll just have to do it with your competitors or somewhere else. And the people who are happy 9 till 5 will stay. And your business will not stay the same, it will decline. So they worked out that actually you can't do it all yourself. You've got to address the second chasm, which Chai will remind me, is about getting the right team in place to allow for growth. And okay, this is me blowing my own trumpet. This is where I came on full time to look at growth. And you think, Tris, rather unflattering, he says, I knew that Jerome didn't know much about business, wasn't probably going to be that good, but I knew he wasn't going to rip me off. And so he was, where it's your own baby, you feel that your trust issues are quite important. And so having someone who you knew instinctively understood your business and was inherently trustworthy, when you're very small, it's actually very important, because you don't have the defenses in when you're a bit bigger. I joined, and my initial remit was to look after the insured risk, which needed looking after, which is an area of specialism I have, but also to say, well, if we want to have a big, hairy goal, and that means opening 5 sites a year, and you want to know that's the broad sunlit uplands are up there, that's what we're all going for, But we've become a property machine there. We've got to find the sites, we've got to develop the relationships, get the planning permission, and open them. And so that was my job. And between 2006 and 2009, and we delivered. We opened five sites a year throughout that period. But the other thing you needed there was the ops director was a one-man band. And you cannot open five sites a year with one person going off recruiting everyone and looking after the operational things. So we had to, we didn't replace him, he's a totally fantastic and core part of our business, but he had to learn to let go and recruit an operational team to allow us to systemize and standardize. So that is what we did as we went up to the recession, which actually for recreational leisure wasn't in 2008 or 2009, it's actually in 2010 when the recession hit. So by addressing the third chasm, which is putting the systems in place, systems and procedures in place, it allowed us to go through that period of fast growth and ride the tiger up. And we grew very quickly. So I can't add up very well. We were up 22 or three sites, and we were a significantly profitable business by this stage. And we'd never done anything other than 20% growth, 30% growth. That's what we were used to. I thought the recession was going to hit. I became managing director in 2009, and terrified at the beginning of 2009. If you remember, it was end of 2008, it was all chaos. World was going to end. We're closed. We open in February, March. We think, is anyone going to come? And then it was our best year ever. So my conclusion was, we are counter-cyclical. People need to have fun in the forest if they're having a difficult time at home. So I thought, right, full steam ahead. We'll put the prices up by 14% and various other good ideas for 2010. And then in 2010, we had a 21% reduction in volumes going through our sites. And we didn't know, we'd never experienced this before. And so is, what do you do when you get a slap in the face from the market? How do you react? We thought, is this, do we batten down the hatches and it's all going to be better in a year or two or in 6 months? We thought, well, actually, it wasn't that kind of recession, was it? This was the new normal. And we need to learn to diversify, to innovate, and to grow out of this. So that's what we did. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute. One of the things which I perhaps should have talked about a little bit earlier, but I think it's really important to get in here now, is that as you standardize and systemize, you cannot be at all your locations. And with an activity like ours, where you can kill people, it is terrifying to think that you've got people who I may never even have met being responsible for the safety of our customers and the safety of our business. You think, well, how do you ensure? Yeah, you can train them, you can have systems and procedures, but that's not really the answer, because that doesn't keep people safe. They can ignore them. If you haven't got the culture right, if you haven't got the brand values right, not just for your customers, but internally, then that was going to be a huge barrier to our successful growth and a real massive, massive risk to the business. So I'm saying this as though we had a sort of clear plan. We thought, oh, look, risk, mitigation, let's build a brand. It was more just within us. But this is, looking back, this was incredibly important to our success, to build an internal brand so that we were confident that our staff would look after our customers and be true reflections of GoA, which is about creating adventure and encouraging everyone to live life adventurously. And so what we put in place was a whole raft of schemes to make sure that we as a team were living our brand values. You might think, oh, well, it's really easy for you because you've got an adventurous brand and we're doing fun things in the forest and outdoors. But I fundamentally believe whatever sector that you're thinking of entering or already operating in, you can have really strong values, really strong brand, internal brand values, or not. And I think it's incredibly important. And I can see it. I'll come on to why I think it's important in a minute. So living our brand values, we put in a whole raft of schemes to make sure that our teams at site understood what we were about, that we were about creating adventure, encouraging people to live life adventurously, zero risk equals zero development, turning I can't to I can, challenging, surprising, exciting our customers. And then we gave them access to a whole load of fun stuff that reinforced that. So they knew that this was a cool place to work. So we've set up Naturally Powered Days, which are two-day events midweek, heavily subsidized by us, where we'll do, you know, tough stuff up mountains, we'll do potholing, we'll do sea kayaking, do paragliding, all that kind of stuff. Well, you know, not super gnarly, but you know, quite gnarly. And we'll lay on the instructors or the guides, we'll get it all organized. It costs you a tenner, you have to get there. If anything's free, people don't value it, is our belief. So you've got to pay a tenner. And that's been going for years. We set up an adventure fund. So you can either organize your own adventure and we'll help fund it. We'll give you kit. We'll pay for kit. Or we'll give you time. But we won't do both. We have expeditions up the climbing the Atlas Mountains in Morocco. We've gone there two or three times. In the Alps, Iceland, good stuff like that. And 12 people can go on it. So the vast majority of people don't, but they know they could. It's very important. They work for a business that does that. We do sponsorship. So that boat there, I don't know if you can see it. It looks big, it isn't. That is a 21-foot yacht that raced single-handed across the Atlantic in something called a mini transat, and it was sailed by one of our instructors, an ex-instructor. And she worked for us for a little bit as an instructor, became a try-hard, trying to be a professional sailor, couldn't get to the beginning of the mini transat, so we helped her over the line. We became a title sponsor. And did we get value? Did anyone see that photograph apart from me as my screensaver on my laptop? Probably a couple did. So it's not brand, it's not developing your brand externally, but it definitely develops your brand internally when you're an instructor. You say, you know what, they really believe it, they believe in us, and they back us. And then in charitable giving, we try and raise or give £100,000 a year is the ballpark. Some years we do better than others, but it's a mixture of engaging your teams because it's the right thing to do. And it's making us put our hands in our pockets. It's quite easy to forget to write a check for charity, isn't it? And by saying we'll back our teams and their fundraising efforts, then it forces us to stick on the straight and narrow as well. We do that. And then there's another great one here, which is the Jubilee Sailing Trust. So these are two tool ships, which are totally kitted out for disabled access. So you can be, as a wheelchair user, you can get up the mast. And they need half able-bodied holidaymakers and half wheelchair users. And we funded them a little bit because we thought we felt guilty that we couldn't have wheelchair access up in the trees. But then we quickly realized that what they needed wasn't so much money, but able-bodied people, because not everyone thinks that's a great holiday. And they were having to cancel wheelchair user holidays because they couldn't get enough able-bodied holidaymakers. And so we cut a deal saying, well, one thing we've got is lots of keen people in their 20s and 30s. And so try and sell your holidays. If you're 3 weeks out and you're missing four or five people, they give us a call and they say, we need three people in Lisbon in a fortnight. So we put that out to our teams. We get them out there. Again, it's not free. We with the JST, we have a scheme where it doesn't cost our teams anything, but they've got to get there. And it's a great thing. It's a great thing. So all of that helps you with that internal brand. It's investing in the long term. It's investing in the retention, the recruitment ability. Because we recruited 3 weeks ago something like 550 people for seasonal work in some fairly difficult areas to recruit in places. And we have no problem each year. People want to work for us. And it's not because we pay more. In fact, on a lot of occasions, we pay less. But they want to work for us, and they stay a long time. And it really brought it home to me, because 2 days ago, I was with great guys doing a fantastic thing in Wales called Zipworld. And one thing they wanted to talk to me about was their recruitment problems. And they've only got 3 signs. I'm like, what's your problem? You. Anyway, I didn't say that. But the so I just thought, we do not have this problem. And we have 33 locations right across the UK. Okay, so it's investing in the long term in your people, but they pay you back. Right, back onto the story. I hope I got about 5 minutes left. Okay. Right, so we hit a recession. We needed to grow. We needed to stretch out. So innovated, we tried Forest Biking, Forest Cafe, Treetop Junior, and Forest Segway. Not everything worked, but Treetop Junior absolutely did. It flew away, and Forest Segways was really successful. And so you try a bit, reinforce success. The other two, Forest Biking and Forest Cafe, they're both profitable. They're both still running one site in each. But it wasn't, you've got to then, once you've spread your net, you've then got to work out what's really popular, where you're going to focus your energies and go for that. The other thing we did is we moved into America. So we started a joint venture, opened our first course in 2010 in the USA. And then, as a result, 2011 was our most profitable year ever. And so was 12, and so was 13, and 14. But it wasn't all beds of roses. We worked hard to respond to recession, and we tried to grow out into new areas and kissed a few frogs on the way. I'm going to skip over that because I'm running a bit short of time. Geographical expansion into dangerous places like Russia. Why did we? I can't, I don't know. Anyway. And South Africa in the age of Jacob Zuma. It's not a very safe investment. So those weren't a very good idea. And we pulled out, luckily, before it was too late. The one where we didn't pull out was trampolining. So we thought trampolinings were great. Trampoline parks were great. And the business case was, we're a very seasonal business. We're all in the summer. We lose money in the winter. We're closed in the winter. We lose loads of money. And we're weather affected. So why not have a really fun recreational activity, which is a weather hedge. When it rains, they go inside. And it's winter turnover. So that was a really good idea. And we thought, they're really dangerous, highly kinetic, you break lots of things. So our expertise in risk management and litigation risk will be an entry into insurance. Other people won't be able to follow us there, and so there'll be a really big barrier to entry. It was great. We were the fourth, trampoline park in the country to open, and we were swamped. We were incredibly successful. So the first site was getting 13,000 customers a week. So at, I can't remember now, £12-13 each. And you just think, wow, this is, forget Go 8, a bunch of losers. You know, we're going to do this. and then we ended up with 3 open, and we had another couple in the pipeline. But we've quickly worked out that we'd messed up, because once we did some analysis, we just saw what was happening. We realized there is no flipping barrier to entry. Any person with £1 million in a shed can put up a trampoline course. They're all coming in. You can't sew up the supply chain. It's coming in from China. And within 18 months, there were over 200 trampoline parks in the country. And it is just chaos out there. And so our analysis was, you can either buckle down, fund it for the next 5 years, and there'll be blood all everywhere, and then 2 or 3 people will emerge as profitable businesses, or you can say good luck to you and sell to the highest bidder. And we sold to the highest bidder, and we sold out in June. And I am so glad we have, because it's a real distraction, and I see their numbers, and I wouldn't want to be them. So what a relief. And there is a lesson there, which is, you know, if you've made a mistake, admit it first of all to yourself, and then do something about it. So I think that's called drowning the puppies, isn't it? Yeah, okay. So we have learnt this the really hard way. Our BGP, whatever it is, blood and sweat growth plan. You probably all know this back to front, but in the bottom left quadrant, you've got here existing products to existing customers. You know, sell more of what you do to your existing customers. We all try and do that. It's called marketing. The next one is new stuff to your existing customers. It's geographical spread. So we have the geographical spread into the US. We now operate in 16 states in America. We're still growing out in the UK. It's what you know. You set up to do that, and you can do it easily. The third area is new stuff to your existing customers. So this is the innovation. Again, you understand your customers. You've got the infrastructure. Bring in new things. Give them something to talk about. It helps with your number one, which is marketing. New for the one that has airspace banana skins is new stuff to new markets, or selling stuff you don't understand to people you've never met before. And it can work, but you're a startup. You're shaking the dice again, aren't you? So best avoided, I now realize. In fact, I think you guys told me that, and we ignored it. But so where have we got to? Well, we've had 7 or 8 million people have gone ape. You know, despite ourselves, we've managed to do okay. We've got a revenue of something like £34 million, something like that. And it's great. You know, we've got loads of challenges, loads of stuff. We've got a team of about 1,200 to 1,500 people in the UK and the USA. I haven't even talked about USA. We're always nearly getting it right in the States. We will get it right this year. And the point I want to leave you with is on your three chasms, proving the concept, chasm one, you do that at the beginning. Chasms two and three don't go away, because at various stages in your journey, you start them again. And if you look at people, the kind of people that you need at different stages of your growth, they just change. Some people will grow, the majority probably will not. And that may include you. It may include you. And so you have to assess that, because if you haven't got the right real senior team with the drive and the vision and the hunger to go to the next stage, if you get a bit fat and a bit too well off, then that can be a real problem. And your systems as well, and your innovation. You can't just do the same thing forever. So that's what I'm going to leave you with. And I hope you found it interesting.